Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready?
Excuse me. Allow me to show you something.
What the Butler Saw with Lee Butler, the podcast.
Look at him, the brats, jump in.
You're a legend in the city.
Brothers and sisters, it's my man Lee Butler.
Wait a second, you're probably thinking what's going on.
Music, clubland stories, and more.
Fantastic, never heard nobody.
You know it makes sense.
We are privileged to have with us this evening
Lee Butler.
What the Butler Saw with Lee Butler.
You shouldn't excite yourself.
This is it.
The podcast.
And so what?
What the Butler Saw. Subscribe now. Visit leebutler.co.uk.
Right, it is What the Butler Saw. Episode 3 of my podcast, which is, as you know, available on my brand new website, leebutler.co.uk. On all platforms there, if you're on iTunes or you're on Android or whatever you're doing, you can get it all there. And there's loads of stuff on my website as well, leebutler.co.uk. Episode 3 of the podcast. We've had Dave Graham in, we've had John Cotton. I am thrilled to bits to have this lad in because he's one of the most talented DJs in Liverpool by a mile, and he can do something that I've never been able to do on the decks, which is scratch. And it annoys the life out of me because he's the master scratcher. And no matter how hard I tried, even on vinyl, I just could not scratch. It can only be the one and only Rob Kane. How are you, Rob?
I'm goodly. That was a nice introduction there, wasn't
it? Thanks, mate. Thanks. So we both come in our caps today.
I know. Well, I'm bald, and that's why I'm wearing one, but...
Yeah, you haven't really got an excuse.
Your hair's dark as hell, isn't it?
Yeah, let's be honest. And as you've noticed, my first thing you said is that my beard matches me hair.
Yeah.
Right, so what I've noticed you've come in today with this, like, nice stubbly beard with just little bits of silver in there.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and, you know, you said to me you've dyed your beard, haven't you, Lee? Well, there's this new beard stick. It's genius, Rob. It's like...
It's going like a pit stick, does it?
Literally like a mascara.
I don't know.
But it's for men. And it just literally give your beard a little touch up.
Sounds
every morning.
Sounds a bit feminine to me, that means.
Oh, come on, mate.
Nah, I can't go for that.
Can't you? Too manly for stuff like that?
No, none of that.
Would your missus give you sticks, you think?
Yeah, she might give me that stick, yeah.
Mate, listen, 30 seconds of a morning, mate, the beard's on by me. Mm. You know what, if I'd have known, I'd have brought it in with me.
I could have touched your beard up for you
while you're here.
My beard would have got a shock if I'd gone home with a full black beard, butler style.
Yeah.
She might have liked it
like
more.
A Turkish guy.
She might have stroked my face.
So, I've got your ear, mate, and I'm made up. We're going to go through some bits and bobs, going to play some
tunes.
Go on. And go through some memories. So, I always start off back in when we were growing up. Now, when I was growing up, obviously, my dad was on the radio, so he was just surrounded by music. I'd hear my dad playing his playlists, playing his old Motown, and lots of, like, 60s and 70s stuff getting played around the house. So I always start there. Was there any musical influences going on in the house? Was any... Your parents or anything into their music? Is it in the blood, do you think, in any way?
It was crazy in our house. A lot of DJs, they always say that their musical history stems from, like, Motown and disco and stuff like that, especially if you play house music. But in our house, my mum and dad were a pair of pot-smoking hippies, so they were into rock and blues and stuff. My dad was into bands like Free and Zappa and Jimi Hendrix
is when someone's into that sort of music, they're massively passionate about it.
Oh, yeah, my dad played the guitar, and he played the drums, yeah, and my mum played the guitar as well a little bit. She was into stuff like Fleetwood Mac and UB40 and stuff like that. So it was the dead musical house, and we always had... There was always tunes playing, and if there wasn't tunes playing, my dad was playing his guitar at, like, Silly Bells in the morning when we were all trying to kip after mad hangovers from the night before. So yeah, it was always music playing in the house. Yeah, it was really lively.
So that all that music you mentioned to me there, but probably, if I was brutally honest, say it's not my bag at all.
It's not my bag at all either.
No, it's not. I mean Fleetwood Mac. Yeah, I love Fleetwood Mac. Yeah. But all that, like, Zeppelin and Hendrix and all that, like I can
appreciate the talent behind it is phenomenal, really. But for me, I was just like, what's this shit? why is my dad playing this all the time? I hate this. And then when I got into, like, rave music and dance music, he felt the same about what I was listening to. This is crap, son.
But I was going to say that to you, yeah. So, like, when I was starting to play house music in, like, 88, 89, 90, and, like, all I used to get was, what's this shite? My dad used to go, it doesn't do anything. Yeah. It's just the same thing right the way through.
It doesn't have to when you're full of joy, does it?
So, you left school. What school did you go to, Rob?
I went to Sacred Heart in Crosby.
Yeah?
Yeah. When I was in school, I was literally the only person who was into like dance music as well. Everyone else in our year.
So what year is this, Rob, when you were in, I left
in 97, but by that time I'd already been a DJ for a good few years. I started like really getting into it in 94, I think it was. And I used to
knock. So when you left school in 97, I'd been at the 051 for like 18 months.
Yeah, well, I used to go to the 051 back in, well before he even left school, because I had a beard when I was 15, so I used to
was
get in.
Was it grey then?
No,
wasn't it grey? Wasn't it?
No. I had a full head of hair as well, which was amazing. It was terrible though. I've got two cow's licks, so it grows everywhere. Like
does it?
Punk. Yeah, it's disgusting. But yeah, no, when I was in school, I was the only person really into it. Everyone else was into Oasis and Blur and stuff like that. So I was kind of a little bit of a musical outcast. The only other person in our school who was into it was Ian Redman, who's like one of my best mates. Oh, and John Hewitt as well, who runs Kingdom. So I was the only person who was really into it. And I only kind of discovered it by house music and rave music by chance as well, really, because I was knocking around with your cousin, Colin, who's Maureen's son.
Yeah, yeah.
And he used to be my best mate, and he used to go around to his. And he'd have the box on. Do you remember the box TV channel?
Yeah, yeah.
Because he had cable, and we never had cable on ours. My mum and dad thought we watched too much telly, so we never had that. And the Prodigies, Outer Space, was on like every hour. Because people would phone up, wouldn't they?
Yeah,
and
yeah,
they'd text
yeah.
in what they would request, yeah. and that would be on every hour. And I was just like, wow, what is this? What is this?
You see, what you're talking about there is very similar to what sort of happened to us when I left school in 1986, and I was going to be a spark, and I was doing like house bashing and climbing under floorboards, but I had my ghetto blaster with me. So 88, 89 was just the start of this house music. And where you're saying like it sort of goes, you go, whoa, what's this? So for us, I mean, I suppose in 97, there's been a decade. Sort of.
This was a bit early. This was probably about 94.
But even then, there's been like quite a few years of this house music coming through. But as when we first were hearing this Italian house and this acid house and this American house, we'd never ever heard anything like it before. Oh, yeah. I mean, like, I suppose 95, 6, then there'd been generations of brothers and sisters that had heard their brothers and sisters playing it.
Yeah.
So it wasn't as instant. But then it was like, what the fuck? Is all these screaming pianos, all these acid riffs, all these 4-4 beats, and all these screaming vocals. This is fucking amazing. So it is that amazing feeling of like, wow.
Well, I was from that, a mate of mine showed me a tape. He was like, if you like that, you'll like this. And he passed me a tape. And it was a recording of Stu Allen from Key 103.
Absolute legend. I've got Stu Allen lined up for the podcast.
I love him. He's a legend, and he's such a nice guy. He's so humble as well. Considering he's been there from the very, very beginning. You speak to him and it's like you're speaking to your old granddad, you know. He's amazing, isn't he? So my mate passed me this tape. It was a Stu Allen hardcore tape. I think it was recorded from the Club Kinetic or something like that. It was a hardcore tape anyway. And it was what he'd put out on his show. And I played it. I was like, wow. This is just like, it was groundbreaking, because in our house, it was just guitars and drums and, you know, people singing. And there was this 165 BPM, like high energy music. And I was like, I was hooked. I was obsessed. I became so obsessed with it that I'd go to town. I used to SAG school with me and Rebna SAG school. And we go to town like every day, get the flyers from 3B, get the flyers from Unity Records, get the flyers from other record shops. You'd be all over our walls. We'd record Key 103. We'd listen to it, analyse it, try and find all the names of the tunes. And back then, without the internet, that was bloody hard to do.
You couldn't
find out what the names of any tracks were.
Nope.
So you just had to go into Freebeat and look at the titles and try and guess what they were. But I just became obsessed with it. I used to write lists of all the tunes I wanted, and they were like pages and pages long. And it just, my obsession was just...
It's funny.
It's still like that now, mate.
You should talk about that sort of hardcore sound that Stu Allen had. And like maybe Fabio Groove Rider.
That was more like jungle to me.
I was never into none of that for me. It just wasn't.
I think being the age it was, it kind of appealed to, at the time, the younger audience, didn't it? If you had gone on, you started in Quadron Park and places like that, and that was acid house.
Yeah.
So it wasn't really a hardcore scene in Liverpool.
And it never was that big in Liverpool, was there?
No access for under 18s to go to house music clubs. So all we got was what we got off Stu Allen on Key 103, because there was no other, apart from Pez Tellet on the radio, there was no other types of outlets.
And that amazing feeling of back then, which we'll touch on in a bit at sort of record shops and buying vinyl, but not really knowing what tunes they were. There was like such a thrill back then, wasn't there? Of like, I'd go on and try to find these songs. Now with the internet and like music comes through via mailing lists and everything, like most of the times now, if you're listening to music, you're listening in your bedroom in yours on your laptop from a music company that's sending you promos.
That's it, yeah.
And that buzz of going to record shops and sitting and going through vinyl
trying
to find that tune or stumbling across a new tune. It's gone, hasn't it?
That was just magic them days.
I can remember going to 3Beat when it was in Wood Street, and me and Paul Bleasdale used to go up to Hot Wax in Warrington, and the battle to get tunes, mate, was just like...
Yeah.
Because there was no way of getting... Like now, producers are making songs and making tunes and maybe they'll pass it out to a few people. But back then, there was no real way of getting anything that early unless you were prepared to press it up yourself.
Yeah.
Which we did a few times.
Oh, yeah,
we could press an acetate up of a track. But there was no way of playing anything early because all you had was your Technics deck. So you couldn't play like a digital file of any sort.
No.
It was just like, if it wasn't on vinyl, you couldn't play it.
That's why people spent so much time getting records, because they knew that that made them individual by having that particular
absolutely,
piece of music.
Absolutely,
absolutely. You play something in the 051 and we'd all be in 3Beat asking for it on the Monday. We've got this tune that Lee's played. Have you got Sonic? Have you got that tune? Have you got Fierce? Have you got days like that? You know, we'd be in there asking for it.
And it'd be like, isn't it a shame that sort Lee's of thing's gone? I mean, the only people who've got a real head start now are the producers.
Everyone produces, don't you know? If you don't produce, you're not going to make it as a DJ.
No, you're right. You're right.
Unfortunately.
And I always say this to the young, like any young people who get older than me and say, Lee, you know, want to be a DJ, you've always got to say, haven't you?
Yeah.
Get into music production, because unless you're making the songs that other people are going to want to play, you're going to be stuck a little bit, aren't you, nowadays?
Yeah. Do your own edits and remixes and bootlegs or whatever you can to get
started. When did you manage to get your first set of decks? So you've left school, you've got this bug, you've got this huge bug for music and house music and like hardcore, and you're listening to Stu Allen. And when did you think, you know what, I want to get a set of decks, I want to get a set? Did you get them as a birthday present? Was it? Did you save up for them?
Well, my first gig actually was, I did my first gig in 97, and then I got my Technics, I think, in 99. And my dad was at...
Did you go straight in for a set of Technics? Didn't get the SoundLab belt drives?
I'll be honest, I had...
I had a set of SoundLab belt drives, I had them for years.
I had this absolute shithead pair, right, and what I'd done is, I didn't even have a pair. I went to a charity shop and bought like an old turntable, and it didn't have any Verispeed on it. You couldn't pitch it up or down. It had like a weird mechanism where when it got to the middle of the record, it went clink, and then it went right back to the front. So what I did, I opened it up and I snapped the mechanism off it and just put a slip mat on it and just used it to scratch. I used to play CDs and scratch over the CDs because I had a little cam made to fade mix. Do you remember those little ones?
Yeah, so this is where the scratching came in.
Yeah, because I couldn't do anything else. And then I think about a year later, probably about 96, I got a very speed one, but I still couldn't mix them together because one of them had no speed on it. So I ended up just like tossing them for a while. But in 97, I got my first gig. So I was already playing on Technics before I actually got a set, because we couldn't afford them. We lived in a big house in Blundell Sands, but my mum and dad were poor the majority of our lives. They worked bloody hard to make sure we could go to school in Crosby and have a good life and all that. So we didn't have a lot of money. My dad was a graphic designer for like a software company that makes computer games. So one month, they couldn't pay him, so they gave him a load of shares. Instead, they couldn't pay him any money. And the company was a company called Psygnosis, and they ended up getting bought out by Sony. So when they did, the share price went through the roof.
Boss.
So he ended up making about £1 million.
Brilliant.
And then he bought me a set of Technics. So that's where I got about 99. So yeah, but he lost all the money anyway, investing it in something else because he was crap with money, like me.
So you get your first set of Technics.
Yeah, about 99.
And are they in your mum and dad's house, Ardy?
No, they're mine.
No, I mean,
I was on them every day for about 5 years.
I got my first set of decks, and they were a set of Sound Labs belt drives, and I just had them set up and literally just drove my mum insane.
Lee, like, I fucked my job off to go play on them every day.
I was a spark at the time, and then, so look, sort of 88, 89, 90, when these illegal raves started kicking off, me and my brother Stuart, who was like, he's 6 years older than me, he was just swept away by it as well. And then obviously the drug scene came in for us then, and we were taking ecstasy and we were up and down the motorways looking for these illegal raves. And listen, I just like, how I clung on to that sparking job, I was just like, we used to go to work, right, me and our Stuart. So the boss would come and drag us out of bed. The boss was mates with me mum, and he'd come and go, are they up, Carol? Are they up? And she'd go, no, so we come in the bedroom. Lads, and ask Stuart. I was like, I didn't want to cause any aggro, so I'd jump up, but our Stuart used to look like, we were sharing a bed in my mum's then, right? Our Stuart had been kicked out by his missus, because he was off the rails. I was just fucking round the bend anyway, right? And all we wanted to do was listen to house music and fucking find the raves. That was it.
Yeah.
So he used to come in and go, lads, you getting up? So I'd go to get up in bed and ask Stuart, because he was the older brother, he'd fucking pinch me and go, don't fucking move. And I'd go, what? He'd go, don't fucking move, you're not getting up. And that's what we'd lie there. He'd go, lads, come on. And I'd hear him saying to me, well, Carol, come on, what's going on with these two? What's the matter with them? And so if we'd end up getting up and going to work, he'd take us to the job. Our Stuart was a joiner. And I was like, training to be a spark. And he'd take us to the job and go, lads, this is what we need doing. The drawers need hanging, leaking. You start chasing the walls out. We go, yeah. So bear in mind, we probably had hardly any sleep. Soon as he'd go, our Stuart had locked the door and we'd just go fucking fast asleep.
And just lie down. He used to
come into the job and go, lads, what are you doing? A pair of us would be fucking fast asleep. So then that never managed to last very long. And you're right, once you get that bug of like,
you can't get
all I want to do is buy music and all I want to do is go on my decks and all I want to do is DJ. It sweeps over you.
Christmas and birthdays and any type of occasion where someone could give you a present becomes about getting another record, or can you give us a tenner so I can go to Free Beat or go to HMV?
That's exactly what I was like. I never had much money when I was 18, 19. My mum and dad had split up and my mum was still living in the house. I was still living with my mum and I didn't have much money, but if I got 15 quid, right, I'd go into town.
I would.
And I'd spend like £7.99 or 8 quid on like a promo that had come in from Italy and that one tune, I'd take it home and just start mixing.
I used to walk into town sometimes from Crosby to buy records. It'd take me 90 minutes, I'd power walk it like I'd had a load of billy, and I'd get in about 90 minutes, but I'd still have all my money to buy records with. I wouldn't have to cut into bus fare. Bus fare was about 15p or something, but you know, it was more money for records.
I was obsessed. Good days then. So talking about your first gig, tell me where it was. My very first gig
was, as I said, back in 97, and in school, as I said, I was best mates with Ian Redman from Ultra Beat, and Ian was just he's a great lad. I love him. He's my kid's godfather, but he is just so full of bravado and bullshit.
Listen, Ian, if you're listening to it, mate, listen.
We need to find, obviously,
I've done a lot in recovery, and there was like these like Cocaine Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous, but there's a new one now called LA, and it's Liars Anonymous. Ian Redman, if you're listening, mate, you need to get yourself to LA. You can imagine Ian standing up, can't you? Hi, my name's Ian Redman, and I'm a liar.
I wouldn't say he's that bad. He likes to have exaggerated.
I'm only messing, Ian. We all love you. We love you, mate. He likes to put an extra tenner on everything, doesn't he?
Yeah. He loved it. But he shared the same type of passion as I did about it, but I just wasn't a confident kid when I was younger. I was kind of introverted, like my own company and all that. But Ian was one of them, going to get us gigs. And so we just started, we started getting flyers for like all these under 18s. Events that started coming through, like The Swarm, which Marco ran, and the Prom in Southport, which Barry Farrows ran. So we just started ringing the phone numbers on the flyers. Yeah, we're some DJs, we're going to come down and do some gigs for you. And Barry Fallows said, yeah, go ahead, come down.
So Barry Fallows, obviously, is the guy who had Fallows.
Well, it's the guy who had Fallows,
yeah,
his son.
So they had Fallows and Speak, Fallows and Aintree, which was brilliant. Tuesday night of Fallows and Aintree were amazing.
Yeah, so Barry said, come down and do the prom gigs for us on a Wednesday evening, I think it was, tea time, in Southport, at the Manhattans in Southport. So that's where we went. And the first time we went down there, we told everyone in our school about it. I was in sixth form by this point. Ian was still younger. So he told everyone about it in his year, and I told other people about it in my year. And like, the train was just full of us. We took about 200 kids with us. So they were absolutely made up. We turned up with like a mob, and they all paid a tenner in or whatever. And then he paid us a tenner each. Nice one, Barry.
That's boss, that, though.
But anyway, story. So we just built our reputation up by doing kids' gigs, and we met Christian, DJ Christian.
Yeah, remember Christian talented lad.
Really good, I love him. He ends up giving us a load of gigs off the back of it, then I'd meet all like the hardcore DJs who I was really into, like Vibes and Hixie and Demand and...
Yeah.
the first gigs I ever done was with you in the back room of Manhattan's. You actually, you didn't turn up to the first time, and then you turned up the second time.
That sounds about right, yeah.
You turned up a month late.
Yeah, that sounds just about right for me, mate. For anything in the '90s, I would have turned up.
Yeah, yeah. So I used to play an hour in the hardcore room, and then I used to go in the house room with Ian, play an hour in there, and I used to do a bit of MCing in there as well.
Brilliant. So listen, if I had to say to you, pick me a tune that reminds you of your first gig. Something that, if you heard it, you'd go, you know what, that just takes me back. Because music's amazing like that. The songs, I always say this to people, you know, music, especially any sort of music, but house music for me, there can be certain house tracks that will put me in a venue. You know, especially Liverpool's got such an amazing history of house music that certain anthems can just instantly take you back to a certain gig or a certain night or a certain club, whether it's Cream, 051, Quad, Paradox, fucking Aquarium.
Yeah.
They've all got their own signature. Yeah, yeah, yeah. For you.
For me, for my first ever gig, I've got two. And I know people don't normally pick two, but I've got two because I played two sets that night.
Okay, so let's go for the first one.
The first one, I played a hardcore set in the main room. And that track is going to be Hixie and Sharky Toy Town, which was just a massive hardcore track.
Okay, so where it is, introduce it for us, Rob.
Is Hixie and Sharky Toy Town.
So, Rob Kane's first tune there that reminds him of his first gig. It is What the Butler Saw. It's the podcast with me, Lee Butler. Today, episode 3 is with Rob Kane in the place with the bass. And we're talking about his first gig. And it was in Southport, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. Manhattan's.
I remember Manhattan's, right on the front.
Yeah, your old swimming baths, yeah.
It was, yeah. So, when I asked you to bring tunes in to remind you of your first gig, one tune wasn't enough, Rob, was it?
Well, no, because I played
two. You don't want to play one more. This fucking sums you up, this.
It does, mate.
You can't get
him
off the decks, you know. Just one more.
Don't like that. I don't like that at all.
So he's said to me that he wants to play two tunes for his first gig. So come on.
My first one was an hardcore set. So the second one, I played a house set. And this is a track that probably resonate with you a little, because you played this loads in the States, I think, and loads in the buzz. And it's Kendo Nagasaki.
Oh.
Yeah.
What a tune. Now, Kendo, as you know, is this the instrumental we're going to play?
It is, yeah. Well, what happened was, I think it was initially released, wasn't it, in 95? And then in 97, it got re-released on FFRR, I think.
It did.
Which is B-Tong's label. And, yeah, I was a big fan of the instrumental version. Wasn't really a fan of the vocal mix, but yeah, I liked the instrumental because he used to put acapellas on.
For those tuned in, of course, yeah. It was one of them songs that was perfect for an acapella. Yeah. I've eaten over it, didn't it?
Yeah.
So this tune, Kendo, I probably put Rock to the Rhythm over the top. We had loads. It was perfect for acapellas. It was a big, full, whacking instrumental with massive pianos. Now, those who listen to this now will go, I remember this as something else. So they will know it as I Need a Lover, which was a local lad, Danny.
Was it?
Yeah, who sung the vocals on that. He had an amazing voice.
Get him on a reminisce.
Yeah, it came back out with a vocal. It was a massive, massive hit once it had the vocal over. Mm-hmm. But here it is, in its original form, it's track number 2.
It's Kendo and Nagasaki.
Tune! Sense. Kendo, absolutely huge tune, and Rob Kane's second pick from his first ever gig was a gig in Manhattan's in Southport when he was a young whippersnapper.
That's the one.
So, talking about legendary Liverpool nightclubs. Liverpool as a city is without a doubt blessed me to have as such. I always say this to people, it's a huge history of house music.
Yeah.
And not many cities have got such iconic venues like Liverpool had. Whether it's like national global brands like Cream or real Liverpool venues like the 051, which is a real Liverpool loving venue, yeah. or the Buzz or the State or the Quads and Park. Or the Underground, which was probably just before the Quad, or, you know, your little sort of pocket nightclubs like the Aquarium, who had its own little vibe and its own little scene, and even the Barcelona or Society, or Garlands. It's just like every person's got a different sort of memory of Liverpool's legendary nightclubs. What are your memories of the... Because I seen a post on your Facebook page where you were talking about nightclubs that you never got a chance to go to.
Yeah, because I would have been the Dock as well, but I went to the Dock when they did the first reunion, and it was in the original building, so I can say I went there. But yeah, the Drome, I never got to go. And it was still around when I started going out clubbing as well, but just by that point, I wasn't really into hardcore anymore, and I was more focused on, like...
Yeah, so I think probably Dave Graham had left then.
Yeah, oh, David had been gone for about 7 years,
so if we're talking
about
the Drome, I can remember, in Birkenhead, and obviously Dave Graham was there, and he had some massive, massive groundbreaking acts on.
I know,
Carl
Cox on, yeah.
You know, like...
Joey Beltram,
when you look
Laurent
back,
Garnier, yeah, people like that, yeah, it was mad.
At some of the acts that they had on the Drome. So, I remember Dave Graham was at the Drome when I was at the State. So we're probably looking like 93, and Dave was in the Drome when I was in the State. And we'd done the quad was like 1991, it was only there for 2 years, and the most unbelievable years. I mean, there's no words I could use to explain how groundbreaking the Quads and Park was. It was just insane. And you have to go on YouTube and Google
look at the videos,
it's just
look
like
Ian Kenyon's old videos of it, and they've got a million views on them, mate. It's just mad,
just
isn't
like,
it?
But you can see that is a generation of people that have been swept away by this new music that we've never heard before. So that in itself, I always say, is unique.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
You know, kids of today, people say to me, and I don't know what your thoughts are on this, of like, do you think the young kids today are getting the same feeling that we did when we went to these nightclubs? I think some of them are. I think some of them are going to, like, you look at some of these huge festivals that are on now that they weren't back then.
No.
Like Tomorrowland and stuff.
But the atmosphere is not the same.
But the production is massive.
Yeah, the production is. But
and I think in their own way, they are having the time.
They're having a good time.
But I don't think they can ever replace. See, these generations of young people now, say you're 18, 19, 20, for argument's sake, they will have been growing up listening to house music, whether it's on the radio. But in 88, 89, 90, 91. There was generations that were blown away by this music they'd never heard anyone playing before.
Yeah.
And then coupled with the drug scene that came with it, and us taking ecstasy, and that went hand in hand with this acid house music and this whole rave generation that kicked off. It's just very difficult to replace that first time.
See, my opinion is, obviously it's good now. The production, as you said, is next level. Back then, it was just a set of shitty speakers in a warehouse and a strobe, but that doesn't mean that it's better now than it was then, because it wasn't. It was new and it was fresh and it was exciting, and the drugs were different and the atmosphere was different. Everyone loved each other. We've seen it all. We've seen it back then and we've seen it now. Do you believe that it's better now than it is then?
No, but you know what, Rob?
I think it's different. It is different.
I don't know if
if you could bottle the atmosphere from the
atmosphere
from 93 compared to
the
Creamfields thing now,
there's no comparison.
And that's the answer.
But people of my generation who went to all these early raves, Quads and Park, State, Buzz, 051, Cream, all them sort of era, sort of 88 to 96, 7, 8. That's sort of decade of clubbing. People of my generation look back and sometimes they can be a bit biased and go, it was miles better then. Now, and they won't look at any of the bad stuff that went on. Now, there's more violence then.
Well, you just didn't hear about it because there was no internet.
But there was more violence then, and people don't want to talk about it because they want to protect that era that they love so much. But there was, you know, I was at in the Quads and Park. The Quads and Park closed down because of drugs and because of violence.
Yeah.
And like, It hurts me to say that because it was the groundbreaker for me. The quality was fucking unbelievable. But there was people having people off in the toilets.
Yeah, yeah. No, there was gangs having people off.
And then if you go to the state, there was shootings at the state. There's a famous shooting that's online you can watch at the state where the doorman got shot. There was scraps in there. Like, I'm talking Barney's, mate. Bottlings.
Yeah.
Nearly every week it would go off in the state.
I remember the buzz. And
when I went to the 051, you know, the 051 used to have some Barneys. There was bombings outside the club, you know. And then, as you said, the buzz. I mean, I went the state in 92 and I was in the state till 95. And then 95, I left the state and went to Buzz. Only went to Buzz for 12 months because I wasn't that fussed on it because it took away for me. It was just it was brilliant in there.
I loved it. I loved the Buzz.
See, but for me, it wasn't quite as clubby as the state or the 051.
No, it wasn't.
There was carpets.
It was like the Paradox, weren't it?
Yeah.
But it was more scally than the Paradox.
It was, but the two of them, the Paradox.
For me, it was about the music and the Buzz.
No, it was brilliant. But it wasn't that underground real club, and like the state is a real underground venue. So was the Quad. The Buzz was a little bit Sharon and Tracy glam.
Yeah, the metalwork, the carpets, and the carpets, yeah,
and stuff like that. So the 051, when I left the Buzz in 96, I went to the 051 for Battle of the Heavyweights, which is October 96 with Dave, to get into that 051 building, just like that underground fucking warehouse cellar, was just like proper clubbing again. But, so I think sometimes we look back and we go, the atmosphere, without a doubt, you couldn't argue, was there's no comparison now. People are going to these clubs and venues and people moan about camera phones, and everyone's on their phone. I just think the young ones take a bit too much stick sometimes. But you know, like, if we had camera phones back in
I'd hate to see what they recorded, Lee.
No, so would I. Listen,
I'd be on YouTube every weekend. I'm glad we never. Jordan and the
but
planet.
What I'm saying is, if we did have the option of a camera phone back in the Quad in 1990-91 or the 051 or the state, would we have used it?
Probably.
We would have.
Probably.
Let's not go into denial about.
I'm not.
It's just that what I'm on about is times change. Technology changes, so like we can't give them stick for being on the phones. They're capturing the moment, but that is why the atmosphere is not as good.
Well, what I'll say is what I've noticed over the years is the energy in a room has disappeared. I remember playing music in the Aquarium in Liverpool, went to a full room, and it being like everyone so tightly pressed together and going for it. It was electric. And nowadays, you put the same amount of people in the same type of room in Liverpool, and it's not like that anymore.
Mate, I agree. Unless it's an old school event.
And this is
why lots of these younger ones, and I'm saying maybe 21, 22, 23, are wanting to come to my gigs, wanting to come to reminisce, wanting to come to the state reunions. And lots of them, people give them stick. A lot of the older ones say they shouldn't be allowed to come.
Yeah.
Okay, so some of them mightn't look right. Some of the lads now with the ket wigs, they're just fucking off putting to look at.
Yeah.
But doesn't mean they're bad people.
No, it doesn't.
But I do get the argument, like, they don't want to be around some of the younger ones. But there's some lovely 22, 23-year-olds who grew up with their older brothers and sisters or their mums and dads, and they know every word to Thria's family. They know every word to fucking...
I get asked for that all the time, mate, in work, all the time. I'm playing to predominantly 21-year-olds.
I try and stick up for them a little bit.
Yeah.
But you're right, there's no comparison to the atmosphere that was created at them venues.
If you go into like the main arena, Reminisce Festival, or the Clubland Arena, it's similar type vibe in there, it's going for it. And if you look out to the sea of people, loads of them at 18 to 21, loads of them, and they're going for it as well. If you're surrounded by that energy, it feeds into you, doesn't it?
And I think this is why these like old school gigs and these classics events around town that we're doing, that's why people want to go to them,
because the
newer music, they're not going for the music, are they?
No,
if people are going to like these big new events with some of the bigger DJs on, they do love some of their tunes, but they're not going to hear that one bass line, that one piano riff, that one tune. You know, at these old school gigs that we do with these classic events, you only have to play something and the bass line comes in.
Yeah.
And you're getting a cheer because they know the music so well.
Yeah. Well, what I've realised over the years is that music nowadays is kind of throwaway. As you said before, I open my inbox every week on a Thursday doing my music. I've got 200 new promos to listen to. You just throw half of them away. It's music so throwaway now, and there's 200 more next week.
Yeah, I do.
Whereas years ago, you buy that record and you play that record every single set for 2 years.
Absolutely.
Play Dan Adore.
Timeless songs.
So when those tunes have got longevity and they've being passed on.
There is some songs, some real classy songs that come about like nowadays. Maybe for argument's sake, I mean, it's not brand new, but it's something that's relatively new. It's not an old school tune. Maybe Man with the Red Face.
Yeah.
That'll stay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because
yeah.
that'll stay timeless.
Yeah.
And that's relatively new.
Well, even stuff like Cola by Camel Fat, yes, you know, well, probably going to be a future classic. Yes, probably is.
Yes, but there's not many of them, is there?
No, there's
not.
Just having one a year.
At songs that we used to play in, let's, for argument's sake, pick one of my favourite tunes I used to play at every club I went to, yeah, whether it was The State, The Buzz, the 051, it stayed with me. So maybe Hyper Go Go, Never Let Go.
Yeah.
Now, for me, I can listen to that 5 times in a row and still never, yeah, ever get sick of it.
It's just fantastic.
And it's tough to find a new music like that now where, yeah, you can listen to it repeatedly for, yeah, decades, yeah, and still fucking feel the same emotion listening, yeah, to it. So I get what you're saying. So Liverpool nightclubs, what was your memories of them?
I've got quite fond memories of most of them, to be fair. I never got to go to the Quad. I was too young. Yeah. I never got to go to the Dock initially back in the time. I never got to go do the Drome, so I can't really comment on them. I went to the States, but later on when it was at Garland, so I was too young initially for, yeah, when you were there. But I used to go to Buzz regularly when I used to get knocked back from the 051.
Right. So you're talking then 98?
96, 97,
so
yeah.
You were 16, 17.
I was
17.
About 15, 16, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And I used to try and get the 051 was the first one we went to. And you were definitely playing. And Dave was on, so was Pez. I don't even think Little John was there.
Maybe
then.
Not my Steve McGee, probably.
I don't think Steve was there. I think Mark was there. I think Mark was doing the warm up back then. Right. I don't think Steve was there either. I think it was my transition time.
Yeah, maybe.
Little,
yeah.
So we went. That was the first time we went out. Was the 051.
See, 96. If you're talking about 96, yeah. I went.
It was probably the arse end of a 96.
My first night at the 051 was October 96.
Yeah.
With me and Dave. So I'd been at the stake for 3 years. 4 years. I went to Buzz for 12 months and then I bumped into John Lynch and John Cummo in Bold Street.
Yeah.
And they said to me, look, we want you to come over to the 051. And I had meetings with them. And at that point, I was getting 50 quid in the estate and I was getting 100 quid in the Buzz. So these offered me my first
proper money,
proper deal.
Yeah.
Now, where you and Dave joined forces, come and there'll be door deals to be had, yeah, and that was my first ever opportunity to go and,
yeah,
get out what I put in.
There's opportunities
what I put in.
Now,
but 96 and Sexy Medicine, which, yeah, we were live on Radio City,
yeah,
that was probably the best 3 years.
Yeah.
I think 96 to 2000, probably 96 to 99.
99 for me, yeah. Right. 2000 started going a little bit sour.
It did. So them 3 years, we locked out every single Saturday. Yeah. And this is when Cream had like Oakham Forward.
I couldn't get in.
We were up against Cream, and Cream were like national, world, global. They're global DJs, Paul Van Dyke. They had every biggest DJ from all,
yeah,
over the world.
Seb Fontaine was resident, wasn't he, at the time as well, yeah.
The Scousers wanted to come to the 051, most of them.
When I used to go to the 051, I knew people from Wales, Wrexham, well, listen, and Chester.
It wasn't
and
just
everywhere.
Liverpool, but it was North Wales. We, yeah, were a really big following, yeah, from North Wales, Chester, Wrexham,
Wigan.
Yeah.
Yeah, all them areas.
But it was very northwest,
yeah,
the 051.
Yeah, it was.
Cream obviously had people coming in from all over the fucking country and all over the,
well,
world.
Well, Liverpool council said that there was problems at the Cream, wasn't there? And they didn't want to do anything about it because they brought so much tourism, yeah, to the city. And so initially, Cream used to get away with murder, didn't he?
Yeah, I know. So, you went to the 051, done some clubbing there.
When I couldn't get in the 051, we had the Buzz. Or, do you remember Heaven? We used to, yeah, the old, the Coach Park now, isn't it?
Yeah,
we used to go there as well.
Yeah, on the bottom of, as you're coming down, Islington.
TJ Hughes's.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, I used to go there. Where else did we go? We used to, before I was a resident there, the Aquarium, we used to go there. Well, we had quite a good, like, local stuff as well. We had the George in Crosby, which is just a pub, but yeah. Thursday nights it was rowdy, like really rowdy. And he had Steve McGee and Mark McGee there, and then
so did the George a few times.
I know. And then there was Sully's and Bootle. I used to do that. I've done that a couple of times a year, yeah, as well with Mark. And then even the Merton was good on a Sunday.
It was.
So
yeah.
We had loads of local stuff that
was
good.
Loads of pockets, even if you, yeah, look like. There was the place on the High Street. What was it called?
Reds.
Chili's, was it?
Chili's, yeah, Chili's.
Well, Chili's was good. Reds, yeah, on Edge Lane.
Yeah.
Reds was amazing on a Sunday,
yeah,
night.
Yeah, Sunday night, yeah.
Was like, so do you think about it? There was loads of little pockets, wasn't there?
I used to do the Masons in the old Swan as well.
Masons was amazing.
And it was shocking.
Before the Masons, the first Ave. Right, I'm talking like early 90s. The first Ave in old Swan.
Yeah.
Up past the Masons. It's not the First Ave anymore.
It's the white one on the corner. Yeah, yeah.
So that used to be unbelievable. Yeah. But even like when we're talking about Heighton, there used to be the pub called The Boundary, which was on Pilch Lane. Yeah. Fucking ropey, mate. There used to be some ab glow in there. The straighteners outside The Boundary were immense. Yeah. But they used to, there used to be an amazing, Sunday nights in the Boundary were amazing as well. And so there was loads, wasn't there, of options to go and get some house music fix, wasn't there?
Yeah, yeah.
Even locally, in local areas.
Yeah, it was great back then, mate, yeah. It was good. So, my favourite, though, which a lot of people resonate with, especially Scousers and DJs alike, is definitely the 05 one. 100%. It was a spectacular when you went there. There was something happening. It felt like you were part of something magical.
Yeah. We did put a lot of work into Dave Graham, Dave.
He's genius, isn't he?
He's attention to detail and knowing what he wants from an event. He won't cut corners. He all the production that went on in there in 96, we had all these statues painted in white and midgets running around.
We had dressed as a devil.
We had actually, probably looking back, the most dangerous fucking fireworks ever. They used to run from one end of the club to the other on a wire. Fire down.
And they've got the awakenings in there.
Yeah.
That day.
Used to fire down, and then we had all the production that no one else was doing. And when we look back now, and I think, fucking hell,
we get away with that.
No, but it was amazing, and that all added to it, didn't it?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it just felt magical. When you got in there, you felt like you were lucky to be in there. It was like hard to get in because there's a queue of 2,000 people, and there's already 1,000 people in the club.
I can relate to that.
Stood at the back, and I'm thinking, shit, am I going to get in here?
I look at that and think about when we used to go to Quad in 1919. We'd go, and the queue would be huge. And we'd have butterflies, club and butterflies from Friday.
That's exactly how it felt.
Do you think people still get them now?
Drugs yet?
No, I know. But listen, you'd have your three shits, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Three? Is that it? You'd have your lightweight.
You'd have your fucking usual excitement shit.
Yeah.
Then but then that buzz of am I going to get in? Am I going to get in? Oh, look at the queue. I hope I get past the doorman. Or if you weren't old enough, maybe.
I wasn't old enough, Lee. This is the thing. I wasn't old enough. So I'd be like, but then the next day when I got it, the next week when you got it back into school or sixth form or whatever, you'd be went to 051. Everyone, oh, did you? Oh, what was it like? Was Lee Butler on? What tune did you hear? Blah, blah, blah. By that time, dance music had been, accepted. So people were interested, and if you told them a club and story, they wanted to know about it.
I know. But getting in, we'd get outside the Crescent Park, and we'd be oh my God, and then that buzz of being in the queue and wondering whether you're going to get in, and then getting inside, you were fucking yes!
How gutted were you, though, when you got knocked back? It's the worst thing ever, especially when you stood behind a couple of nice girls.
See, the state used to be really hard to get in. When I first started DJing, I was DJing in the Phoenix in Cantle Farm, so this was probably 90... After the Quad had finished, I'd done all my clubbing and fucking was around the bends. I got my decks and I was trying to earn money to buy tunes. So I was just doing the Phoenix and Canny Farm and Dovey Labour Club and stuff like that. So I'd finished there at 12 and then I'd go into town in 92 to get into the state. And by 12 o'clock, the doors would be shut. Yeah. But I got to know the boss, Alan Larkin and Cliffy. They were two ex-policemen.
Alan had the drone, didn't he?
Yeah, he had the drone as well. The same two people had the drone. So I'd knock fuck out of the door. The wooden doors for ages, and in the end they'd open and I'd get in now and again, but it's nothing worse than not getting in.
I tell you a story about me getting knocked back. For a little while I was the flyer boy for the 051 and Garland's, and I used to go up to the offices in the 05 offices, pick up my big box of flyers, speak to everyone in there, speak to John and the other John and everyone else, occasionally say hello to you, Jed Clark and all them, and then I'd go and stand outside HMV on Church Street and hand out flyers all day. And one weekend, I come in, I got my wages, and I was speaking to John Cummo in the office. And I said, I'm thinking about coming to Garland's this weekend. He went, oh, yeah, I'll be outside, I'll see you there. So that Saturday, I turned up to Garland's with my mates, and I walked to the door, and I'm like, all right, John. And he goes, all right, not tonight. I went, what?
Gotta be.
You can't come in here, mate. It's not your type. I went, I work for you. I don't know you.
I know. Come on, was ruthless. But Garland's had to be the hardest place to get in.
But he told me I could come, and then I said, this looked like a bellend. It used to be, mate.
I used to ask you, he used to phone me and say, we're going to try Garland's tonight. Can you put us on the guest list? This one, I was at the 051, and we were doing Friday nights in Garland's.
Yeah.
And I had a dead good relationship with John and John, the two owners, doing me mates. And I'd say, yeah, I'll sort it. And I phoned John, come on, can you put our Stuart on the guest list? He'd go, yeah, no problem, mate. I'd pull him on and say to our Stuart, you're on. He'd go, yeah, I'm fucking going to get in now. I went, yeah, you're on the guest list. I've spoke to fucking John. You're on the guest list. Stop fucking worrying about it. Just go up. What do I say? What do I say? So just say I'm on Lee's guest list. And he'd phone me about fucking 11:30 and say, I've just been fucked off.
He
said, nah, not tonight. Yeah.
But you know, that's what made that place special. Listen, because you couldn't bloody get in there. It was safe. It was safe.
Listen, and they had some crowd in there.
And I used to go on the Fridays when you used to do Peach. And I remember watching you on the same bill as Tiesto and K-Class. It was just like the craziest lineup ever.
I know.
It was mad.
Yeah, Fridays were good.
But it was dead energetic. That bottom room was just energetic.
It was almost like Hard House, Fergie, Nucleus,
BK, and all that. That's what it was like. It was good.
Some gate when you listen back to some of them old Nucleus tracks, mate. Aren't they?
They're amazing. They've got raw energy.
Ruthless. So quickly, want to talk about your unique style.
Yeah.
So what I like about certain DJs is that you could put. I always talk about this ability to blindfold you and
you walk in and you know it's them.
You know someone's on.
Yeah.
Right, and that's a compliment.
Yeah.
To DJs, because I know if I went and listened to probably John Kelly, I'd know John was on.
Yeah.
He's got his unique sound, his style, his acapellas, his creativity. I just recognise it straight away. I'd know John was on. Probably the same with Mike Nola.
Yeah,
I'd probably know if Mike was on if I went to an old school night and he was on the set list. If someone said he was on now, I'd probably be able to know it was Mike. Dave Graham, the same. He's got his signature tunes. You'd sort of know it was Dave.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're the same. One, it's your style of DJing.
Yeah.
You know, you're quick.
It's really quick, isn't
it? It's quick.
Sometimes
it's dead energetic. There's lots of scratching, lots of acapellas. Yeah. Where does that come from? Because people make a joke about it. Rob Kane, he's got the ability to play 100 songs in fucking...
I have done as well. I've played 100 songs in an hour before. And it seems like a lot of hard work, but it just kind of... because I've been doing it that long...
Listen, I know what you mean. Sometimes...
You know, when you've put it all together, you go, fucking hell, played 100 songs there. I've only been on...
But sometimes the first verse and chorus is enough certain songs.
Well, it all stems for me because you didn't really... When you got booked for DJ gigs, you get booked for an hour. And for me, an hour didn't feel like enough time. I felt like in that hour, I had to cram in as much as I possibly could. I've got 50 records I want to play
there. So I do loads of private gigs now. And like weddings and like 40ths and people's birthdays. I'm flooded with them. So I get to do an hour at these gigs.
I'm
the same. I'm trying to put like... A lot of the time, you're playing mashups. You're playing like... Yeah. Tunes that have got four or five tracks in that one track,
so because you can
get your all your tunes in.
I was just,
but it works, Rob.
I felt, you know, also like I always felt bored waiting for that you know, that standard mix point, that point where everyone mixes out that track.
You're safe, mix point.
Yeah, and I just felt like, shit, do I have to wait 9 minutes for this track to finish so I can mix the next track? And fuck that, I'll just mix it after, you know, 90 seconds or whatever. The best bit's been on. Why do I need to wait for 9 minutes?
Listen, you're right. There'll be certain songs I still play now, and it'll be first breakdown,
out.
Kick back in, big piano riff that the payoff is, and then I'm off. Yeah. I want out of it.
See, you're out. You don't need to play the whole thing.
Usually it does the same thing again.
And whenever there was like little bridges and tracks where there was nothing happening, I thought I'd either throw a scratch in it or I'd put an acapella over it just so it became a little bit more interesting. And so it just gives the sets more energy, and I've been like that forever. Me and Ian Redman pretty much mix the same. That's how we learned. It was because
I'd say you're a little bit neater than
no I think Ian's a bit more neater. I'm very slapdash. I'll throw it in, here's a question for you, and I know what my answer is.
So people go on about like, mixing and fucking this beat, perfect mixing and fucking sublime mixing. Not right for me. If someone said to me, look, do you want to go to a night where this DJ is going to do 3 hours of the most fucking amazing tunes, and he's going to try and get creative, but listen, some of his mixing's going to be, some of his levels of his tracks aren't going to be quite right. You'll hear the beats slapping in too loud.
Give me it.
Or do you want to go listen to someone that's done a pre-planned set? You won't even hear the mixes. It'll be fucking absolutely perfect. You'll hear nothing coming in, nothing coming out. See, after time, when these people are doing these fucking perfect 2 or 3 hour sets, I think they're picking certain songs because they mix well and not because they work.
Yeah, because they're harmonically in key, aren't they? Not because they're the right tune for the right moment.
Give me a DJ that's fucking going to slap the tunes in, take risks, put acapellas in, and it'll clash with another vocal, so we'll drag it out. I don't care.
I don't.
Give me creativity. Yeah, give me excitement.
Yeah.
Like, it's nothing better than that next beat kicking and it's too loud, but it's in the mix and it's like boom, 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 boom. And you're like, fucking get in.
You can hear it coming in, yeah.
Yeah, man.
I'm ready for it.
Totally.
It's like, yeah, it's queuing you up, isn't it? Yeah, I love all that. I'd rather listen to a sloppy mix that's full of absolute gems than to something that's perfect, but a little bit, feels a little bit, you know,
boring, fake. Planned. Yeah, real. I agree.
I'd rather feel the energy in the mix, you know.
Totally.
You hear someone tapping it in. I love those little taps.
Oh, listen.
Old tapes you can hear.
You hear the movements.
Oh, yeah.
Real. Give
me
real.
Or you hear the record skip and you go, oh, you know, it's live.
Yeah.
And then you've got to take it back again and mix it again. Yeah. Love it. I love it.
Love it.
Love all that.
You can hear that in your sets, mate. So we're at the point now where we're going to pick another tune.
Yeah.
Tune. And I always ask this to everyone. I've had Dave Graham in. I've had John Cotton in. So if I ask you to play you the track that reminds you of Lee Butler...
Like, this is like really hard.
Yeah,
and I'll tell you why. I was gonna pick one that I know you hate. I was gonna pick Jamiroquai Space Cowboy because I know you think it's a pile of shite.
don't do that to me.
but I know we've very lucky. We've been blessed with so many of your anthems over the years. So it's a bloody hard question. This, and I've thought about it.
What ones did you go through?
Let me
to try and guess what you go through. Did you think overdubs?
I did.
Yeah, did you think Hypergogo, Never Let Go?
I did, but I know John Cotton had already done it, so I couldn't pick it.
So where did you end up?
Well, I was thinking...
Did you think Swankenstein, Music Lover?
No, I didn't think that one, but that is a big Lee Butler thing, isn't it? For me, it was more around the area, at the time when I was going to 051, so Sexy Medicine type era. So for me, like the best time was 98. That was the best for me.
Yeah, so a lot of people think that, yeah.
I was thinking... A little bit out of the box with stuff like, do you remember Magnetic Pulsar?
Let Me Take You. Amazing.
Yeah, I was thinking along the lines of that. And then I know that Dave Graham had already picked Sonny, the conductor and cowboy thing. I was thinking maybe Space Brothers, Forgiven or Shine. Oh, but
what a tune.
I picked a track that, for me, became one of those tracks that was so bloody hard to get hold of. And you were the only bugger that played it, apart from once when Dave Graham played it in the 051 and we were fuming with him.
I know.
And this was so hard to get hold of. You'd be in 3 weeks every week asking for it for years.
Do you know what, Rob? That's what I miss about, like, them vinyl buying days and, like, the ability to get a track that no one had. I mean, I know it can happen now because you can be producing your own music.
Yeah, you make
but
it,
back then, it was all about trying to fucking get that. And I got this vinyl with this tracking, and I was like, because I used to love the original of this. We won't mention what it is yet, but the original of it.
I love the original as well.
Right, it was one of my favourite
tunes.
It's
the campus record ever.
It's absolutely
amazing.
Unbelievably camp, but it's got an amazing storyline in it, and like that's one of my.
It's beautiful. I always said to me wife that I'd like, if I die before me time, will you play it at the end?
No, seriously, and I'm always been a big fan of songs that have got meaning to them.
Yeah.
Like the same with Space Brothers Forgiven. It's a fucking unbelievable vocal and it's a great storyline.
Yeah.
You know, and like, even if you go more obvious, like Degrees of Motion, Do You Want It Right Now?
Yeah.
Great song, great story.
Yeah.
CC Peniston, Finally, great song,
this
story.
It's got emotion though, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's
a raw emotion.
Ah, it's just... And
it's a beautiful track.
And you know what, Rob? It's funny because it's bordering between absolute cheese and absolute genius.
I think.
Don't you think?
No, you know what I think?
Like, if I reckon if you played this, picture the scene, if you went and done a gig with, like, some of these top jocks, like, it's like, that's, like, and I love Tall Paul. He's my mate. I love the guy. He's amazing. But some of them, like, early jocks would maybe frown upon it.
I think the
do you think I'm right?
I think so. But I think the fact that the girl who's covered it has done such a good job of the cover, then it's kind of taking it out of the cheese zone into kind of credible. Because I remember seeing it on lots of compilations as well when I was younger. I was like, oh my
but
God,
the mix itself was amazing.
And it's 10 minutes long.
I know, but it's
and
like...
And you want to play all 10 minutes.
But it still sounds good today. It's like meaty, trancy, loads of big...
I'll tell you a funny story about it as well. I was trying to get in touch with the original artist who made it. It's a German guy, because I was thinking, if I get in touch with these, maybe they'll... Lee will put them on at Reminisce.
Absolutely,
get the original vocalist.
Yeah.
It took me months. I finally tracked this fella down over the loads of email and all that. Messaged him and went, are you the guy who made, you know, this track? And he went, it sounds like something I would have made. I went, don't you remember making it? And he went, yeah, kind of. I remember a little bit. And he didn't remember it.
Didn't he?
And I was like,
How dare you not remember it?
This was the song that took our wigs clean off in the 051 every single week. And that song is...
Wait, before you say it, talking about this track. Now, I used to put acapellas over this.
So did I.
Yeah, I know. So what acapella would you... think of when you
I know exactly what acapella you would have put over this, and it would have been Alternate 3.
Yes.
That's the main one, but there was loads of other ones as well.
Donna Giles, the new one. So let's play, because that's some fucking build up, that, Rob.
Oh, mate.
Anyone who's listening to the podcast will be going, fucking play it!
You best play 9 minutes of it at least. If you don't, you're an arse. Yeah, this is Legato and Small Town Boy.
What a tune.
Get on it.
What the Butler Saw, the podcast, episode number 3, with me, Lee Butler, and in the hot seat today, my main man, Rob Kane. You can get this via my website, leebutler.co.uk, and everything's on there. There's loads of stuff on there, gig guides, loads of blogs from myself as well, and you can listen on any single digital format you want to, whether you're on iTunes or whether you want to go on Spotify or wherever you are. If you're on Android, they're all on there as well. So we've just heard Rob Kane's tune that reminds him of me, and he's picked Legato, Small Town Boy, and loads of people will absolutely relate with that massively, because it's a real, real Butler anthem, that one.
It was so bloody hard to get hold of. I think if it had been easy to get hold of, people would have forgotten about it a bit more.
Yeah.
But you couldn't get it. It was that double pack as well with a star on it.
It was
impossible to get hold of.
I know, it was.
I think I bought a copy in the end from someone. Someone came into Freebeat with a copy, and it was just like random. I went, I'll give you 40 quid for that right now. And he went, go ahead, yeah. So that's how I ended up getting a copy, spending over the odds. But he probably could have got 100 nicker out of me for it.
I know.
Because you just couldn't get the bloody thing.
No, I know. So talking about record shops, we've all got great memories of going like to many record shops, whether it was 3Beat or Unity popped up, and you've got maybe Quantum.
Yeah.
With Justin. On County Road. So we'd all have our great memories, but you worked in a record shop, didn't you?
I worked in most of them, yeah. I started in with Ian in Plastic Records in the Palace, which was downstairs, and it was just a second-hand record shop, but it was like, it had a really great vibe in there on a Saturday when people were coming in, and we ended up buying loads of new stuff in.
Listen, it was like I don't know what the word is for a gathering of DJs, a gaggle of DJs.
But
it'd be like a social meeting, wouldn't it?
Of course it would, yeah. That's what record shops were like then. People were coming in and be like, oh my God, you hear what such and such did at the weekend, or oh, he's been shagging someone, let's bird him, or whatever. You'd hear all about it in the record shop. The gossip was there. There's a new club opening up, we need DJs, and like everyone would be like that, sticking their head around the listening posts, trying to get it.
But then when Cream was at its height, that you get like some of the bigger jocks. I remember Boy George popping into 3Beat when he was there,
and Sasha when I worked in 3Beat.
You'd be a bit starstruck, wouldn't you, when you come in?
Sometimes you would, but I think initially for us it was all because we were all predominantly Scouse House lovers, so we were only asked about seeing you and Dave Graham and the other lads. That's all we cared about.
And I say this to
people, George coming into us, we would have been like, fuck off, George.
Listen, but I say this to people, like those who loved their Liverpool nightclubs, whether it was the State or the Buzz or the Quad or them really Liverpool ones. Cream, of course, is the success story of Liverpool. You can take nothing away from Cream. They're a huge, global, worldwide success. But the Scousers had this link to, like...
Scousers love Scousers, Lee.
That's, yeah, yeah, and so... when you speak, I speak to people who used to go to the 051, for example, it means the fucking world to them. It means, the memories mean the world to them. And like, you know, I was on my social medias this week. I've been keeping in touch with the people who've got the 051, and it is due to get demolition dates. They're waiting on demolition dates now because I want to get in there to
it's
get some
fucked,
stuff.
Though, isn't it, inside?
It's not that bad inside, you know, Rob.
I heard there was a massive flood in it, though.
It's not that bad. I managed to sneak in under the shutters about 3 months ago.
A mate of mine was doing some work in there, and he said it was like, it was 3 foot in sewage.
Nah, it wasn't too bad when I got in there. It was just, looked like it was just run down.
Yeah.
Well, all the old, everything was, DJ boxes still there.
All the signs still up.
The signs are still up. The disco ball, which is what I want. And I want little mad things like the old phone box that's on, like as you go down the stairs on the right.
Yeah.
The phone box is still there. So I want to get these out before it gets demolished. So I'm liaising with these people. I put it up on my social media and people get, there's, of course it's sad that these nightclubs go, but people need to realise that they closed for a reason because they weren't successful.
Yeah.
The Quadsden Park shut because it had run its course, there was trouble, and the numbers had dwindled.
Sometimes the trouble overdoes the success.
The state was amazing, but when I left and went to Buzz, the state dwindled away and it shut because it wasn't really performing. The Buzz was the same. The 051 was the same. It had we had a great run in the 051, like a decade, more than a decade, which is amazing. But in the end, a big, massive nightclub like that, it couldn't survive.
Yeah.
And like, so I choose to look back with massive happiness that we were lucky enough and blessed enough to have been part of these clubs. Because I look back at the Quad, and yet it does. It makes me sad in a way, but massively fucking blessed to have been part of it because we were lucky. We were very, very lucky to have them big, proper nightclubs in Liverpool that meant so much to us because they're not there now.
Well, no, if you look at the size of them.
It's all bars and small clubs.
Yeah, the clubs are small. They're all 500, 600 capacity, aren't they? There isn't any super clubs.
And lots of them are like bars.
Yeah.
Bar show clubs. So that real industrial fucking huge nightclub.
That's exactly what it is. It's like a bar club.
Yeah, it's gone. So we need to look back with like joy and go, fuck me. Wasn't I lucky to have been part of all that?
Yeah. We are lucky.
Let's talk about the aquarium.
Okay.
Because lots of people, when I talk about Rob Kane, say, oh, I remember Rob in the aquarium of a Thursday.
Yeah.
What's your memory? I was in there the other day. It's phase two records and it's been turned. Have you seen it now?
Yeah.
It turned it into a little warehouse, you know.
Yeah, I don't believe so.
It's boss. It's really good. I've been looking at doing something in there.
Yeah, good. Let's do it.
Yeah. No, you're right. You're the first person I thought of.
The aquarium for me, I kind of, as I mentioned, I keep mentioning Ian, but he's kind of pivotal to most of my stories involving getting gigs. Ian was working in Plastic Records initially, where I was eventually took over from him. And Barry Mack said he needed an additional warm-up DJ for downstairs, because there was two rooms in the aquarium. It was like a downstairs room, which played predominantly funk and house and stuff like that. And then there was the upstairs room, which was all Scouse House-y type stuff, big anthems and that. And they needed a DJ. Fair effort to help. Do you remember Matt Ashton? I used to do the flyers there. Yeah. You need another DJ to help Matt out, who was downstairs. So Ian said, I'll do it. I don't want any money. But then he said to me, I need to lend some records off you, Rob, because I've not got enough records to do all my good ones. So I was like, well, if you're going to lend me records,
I'll do it.
I'm coming.
Yeah.
I'm coming, mate. So it's it. And I ended up, yeah, just doing the odd hour here and there when they were getting too mangled. So, yeah, I ended up downstairs. I was downstairs for years. I was.
And when you look back now, Rob, right, and you think at the aquarium on a Thursday night, this is a Thursday night.
I know.
It's hard now to fill nightclubs on
There's
a Saturday.
500 people in
these
this club.
Amazing venues around town, all these venues, are struggling to just get one good Saturday night.
I know.
And we were like, if I look back even further, I remember Tuesday nights at Fallows in Aintree was fucking locked out.
That Tuesday night, Plumbers.
If you look at Plumbers and Kirklands and all up them way streets. But then you look at like the main event.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the main event.
Monday night.
On a Monday night. Bank holiday Monday night.
Everyone's in work Tuesday.
3,000 people were in work at 8:30 in the morning.
It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't,
No. It's crazy, isn't it? But that Thursday night at the aquarium was fucking immense.
I know it was. It was great. And he put a lot of production to it. Barry Mack put loads of time and effort into it, didn't he? I remember when he was doing those like little gimmicks, like the granny and the knitting in the middle of the dance floor, and people would be like, off their heads, and they'd be like, no one wants to say anything because they were all scatty, and there's a granny knitting in the middle of the dance floor.
And you'd be debating in your own head.
You would say that to me, mate, and you'd be looking at you going, do I say it to him?
Am I tripping me bollocks off here, or is that really there?
I tell you, the best one that I saw in there was this lad and this girl come walking in, and they're fully dressed in police, a proper police outfit, proper police outfit. And they walk up to the stage, and like one of them climbs up on the podium, and the other one climbs up to the other podium, and then they're nodding to the DJ. I can't remember who's DJing at the time. I think it was Cocky or someone like that. Nodding to the DJ to tell him to turn the music off, and the DJ lowers the music off, and then he just turn around and he just whip the kits off and just start dancing. The music comes on, and everyone went bananas, yeah. Mate. And
gimmicks,
little gimmicks like
gimmicks,
that made it so special.
Yeah.
You were like you were in awe of what was going to happen. Was the granny going to come out? Was the little devil midget going to come out in the 05 one and poke you in the arse with a spear? You didn't know what was going to happen. Back then it was Boss.
I know. When I mentioned on my socials about the 051 shot, and I asked for people for some of their special memories, I got like so many different stories. People talking about the confetti cannons and talking about Scally's Corner or the Funk Stop or getting up on the VIP balcony. Then others are talking about getting nicked by the doorman, fucking with ease on them. And some of them are talking about getting a fucking hiding in the 051 in the fucking, in the fire fucking escape. You know, like
it was ruthless. That
like it's just so many amazing memories. But it can be the smallest thing, mate. That can make you think. It could be like the production. It could be someone you met there. So. Aquarium, I'm going to ask you for it should be our third song, but you picked two for the second one. So it's our fourth track of the podcast, and we're now in the Aquarium. It's a Thursday night, and I'm asking you to play me one of your favourite tracks from the Aquarium.
This is really hard, and I'll tell you why it's so hard, because at the time we had a massive sea of big trance type anthems come out. So initially I was going to say, let's go for something like System F Cry, which kind of pivotal for the time. And also I remember you playing, which was so big in the Aquarium, Karen Ramirez, Looking for Love. Trouser Enthusiast,
what a tune.
It was like 12 minutes long or something, and it took 4 minutes to kick in.
Listen the Trouser Enthusiast remix of Looking for Love. Oh my God! I mean, I forgot about that until you've just mentioned it. What? It was one of my. I used to play it in Garlands on a Friday night.
One of my favorite tunes.
It was just amazing. But you look back now. I mean, if you drop that now, it'd probably fucking flatten the place.
Of course it would. Yeah, 4 minutes in before
it'd
the beat comes
it'd
in,
kill,
people would be. Yeah, people be swinging for you, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
Back then, I remember it being. It was like Lee's ear.
It was that amazing
Boss.
Vocal and storyline and emotion.
Oh, it was Boss, yeah, but. I'm going to go for something a bit more high octane.
Go on.
Which sums up me and sums up the Aquarium. And I'm going for a big Dutch House record.
Give me the Dutch. Massive
Dutch House record. Stinks of Green. This is Lock and Load and Blow Your Mind.
Oh, come on. This is a tune.
What the Butler Saw with Lee Butler, the podcast.
Allow me to show you something.
Music, clubland stories, and more. Subscribe now. Visit
leebutler.co.uk. What the Butler Saw, episode 3. The podcast with me, Lee Butler, and in the hot seat today, Rob Kane. He's just played me a tune that reminds him of the Aquarium, and it is the massive Lock and Load, which is still timeless. You can still play it now. You see some of the bigger DJs dropping it.
I saw that Dennis Salter playing it. At some Heidel Festival, I think it was.
That is one of them tunes, mate, that will fit in with any set now. Whether it's an EDM set or whether you're playing a tougher
playing
house set.
120 BPM as well, and I'm like, wow, I didn't realise it went that slow.
What a clever song.
It is.
I mean, I know it's an instrument. Well, it's sort of an instrumental. It's got a rap
in
it.
Was? It was that triplet bit in the middle. No, where did you ever hear that before? You
It was so powerful, Rob, wasn't it?
It just took the roof off.
It did.
As soon as that happened, everyone's drinks went in the air.
We use it at Raven Fit. It's one of the hardest workouts.
Of course.
That particular track, we have them jumping where it goes on the do. They all have to jump as high as they can, and everyone's fucking ripped off by the end of it. So, Lock and Load, Blow Your Mind. Here's a question for you. Would you regard that as Scouse House?
Yes. And let me tell you why. Some people wouldn't. Some people would probably say, oh, it's Heart House.
I wouldn't.
It's Bounce or whatever. for me, Scouse House was such a broad spectrum. Initially, it was such a broad spectrum of different types of music. So
yeah, because in the end, Scouse House got a bad name.
Scouse House became Bounce and Donk, which is what I'm kind of predominantly known for, isn't it?
But it got frowned upon. Now, one thing I am passionate about is disliking music snobs. Yeah. I can't stand them. Because I tell you why, if someone wants to listen to fucking Michael Bublé, or someone wants to listen to 190 BPM fucking happy hardcore, why shouldn't they?
Yeah.
Why should we? Because you don't like it. Why should? That's the amazing thing about music. Everyone's entitled to have their own taste. Well, that's what makes it magic. But this whole Scouse House, now, I think the reason it got labelled Scouse House is because Scouse rhymes with house.
Well,
and it was a nice rhyme.
It was Pez from 3Beat, wasn't it, who coined the phrase initially so they could sell records that you guys were playing in the bus on the 051. And so they needed
ended up getting us, some DJs,
labelled as scumbags.
Yeah, yeah. Like Scally DJs, well, who play that shit Scouse House.
Well,
and like, if you look at Lock and Load, blow your mind. Or I'll give you another one, Sleepers Infinity.
Yeah, it's produced by the Venger Boys, like, you know.
Right, but what an amazing tune. Right, yeah, and there's loads, sound design, happiness.
Yeah.
Can you class them as Scouse House?
I'd say so, yeah.
The problem you've got is, when you're talking about them three songs, and then you compare them to, say, Breeze and Styles Heartbeats.
Yeah.
Or
they're not the same type of thing.
They're not. Or you go into Alex K. Alex K, for example.
Yeah.
And some of his really heavy donk sound and Scouse, yeah, which I wasn't a fussed on.
Yeah.
But they're two totally different feels, but they both get classed as Scouse House.
This is what I'm saying. Scouse House initially was, when you go the 051, you listen, in essence, you listen to Scouse House, but you'd hear big Italian piano house, you'd hear funky stuff, you'd hear trance, you'd hear the hard house, you'd hear the big donkey stuff, you'd hear all sorts of different stuff, and that was all Scouse House.
Because Scouse loved it.
It had a certain edge to it that made it fit into that 051 type sounding category. Whereas when it evolved, it became, obviously, you guys had BCD Records, yeah, and that was the benchmark.
Of course,
it was. This is Scouse House to the rest
of
the country.
We started BCD Records, which was Butler Calvert, to Les Calvert, and Discala, Mike Discala, who's just obviously now is Camel Fat and has gone on to become like fucking the superstar he deserved to be.
He deserves it. He's talented. He's ridiculous.
He's just like insane.
I'm in awe of him.
I am.
He makes me sick.
Listen, well, when we had BCD, we'd go and sit in Mike's, his house in Brookside, and he had the oldest computer that kept freezing all the time.
Yeah.
Right. That's where he started making, self-taught, like, and even then, you knew.
Yeah.
He was the best.
I made a couple of bouncy tunes with him about 10 years back, and he made them in about an hour.
He's the best. He can sing, he can write.
Can he dance, though?
He can write melodies. He's just scarily
he's
talented.
He's probably got a massive piece as well, hasn't he?
Listen, Mike, if you're listening, mate, and you're well hung as well, we're deleting it off our phones now. You can't have it all, you fucking sexy bastard.
He's still got all his hair as well.
I know he has. He's the Italian stallion, isn't he?
Yeah, he's boss.
He is super talented. Him and Whelan, Dave Whelan, now Camel Fat, and probably the biggest DJs in the world, near enough.
He's recently just collabed with Noel Gallagher as well, haven't he, or something?
But you go as far as to say that maybe the hottest property in the world.
In the world. In the world, yeah. But they deserve to be, don't they? They do. And they've stuck by the guns, and they've worked bloody hard at it, and they've crafted the sound, and they deserve it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, that whole Scouse House thing, so you're talking about BCD. So, it was at that point that me and Mike and Les Calvert went, let's start making some of these tunes now. So I think Resonance Q Someday had just come out, Mike had made.
That's it, yeah.
Right. So off the back of that, we did all them BCD songs, which was some fucking amazing songs on BCD.
And some of them are timeless as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Some mad stuff like Walk the Dinosaur, which was ridiculous.
Yeah. I played Alita, the Get Here thing.
I played the B-side now.
Yeah. Do you?
Yeah.
With the Hard Knocks one with the breakdown in the Stephen Arnold type. But like, the reminisce last
Alita
year.
Adams' Get Here was something I used to play in the States,
remember,
and just played the start. The start was really slow, the original, and as it had finished with, you just get here if you can, I just dropped like Asher or big piano tune that was hard to mix. It was a way of like getting out of mixing something tough.
Yeah.
But everyone had sing it, and I just thought, you know what, I want to do that. Yeah. I want to do that. But that whole BCD thing, but I'd say BCD was the credible side of Scouse House. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it was, because there was BCD, and then Australia had Dinky Records, which again was more hard housey, but again it was kind of credible. It wasn't really
cheesy.
But you
had loads of these producers in that era, like Hypersonic, Stevie Brett.
Yeah.
Who were the lads you used to do stuff with?
Dizzy DJs. Sorry, yeah, I was producing under Total Control, wasn't I? Yeah.
Paul
Holden?
No. Quadrasonic. So there was loads of them that come off the back of that sort of sound, and there was a more credible sound to that. It was tough, but didn't have. Well, let's cut to the chase. The BCD stuff never really had a donk in it.
Very rarely, if it did have, it was subtle.
It was a very subtle, bouncy fucking twist on a donk. It was never that real horrible donk.
Yeah,
and it was the donk side of it that a lot of people will say.
That's shit.
When it took it to the fucking shit level. And then what happened then is...
That became the super popular sound though, didn't it?
The Pleasure Rooms then.
Yeah.
But I think what happened then is all these big... Lots of big pop songs started getting a fucking donk lashed over them, didn't they?
Yeah, and that was the beginning of the end.
Yeah, and that's when it all became like... But it was still working in the Pleasure Rooms. It was fucking rammed.
Yeah.
They were live on Juice. Some people will look down on the Pleasure Rooms and go, fucking hell, that's the fucking... But the fact of the matter is, mate, fucking hell, that meant as much to some people as
it does. I speak to people out also, and I'll be honest...
And this is what I don't like, Rob. People go, fuck that, the Pleasure Rooms. It was full of fucking scally scruffs. But listen, it wasn't. It was full of people who fucking absolutely loved that time and that music. And if it wasn't your bag, then don't go.
While I was there, I didn't really appreciate it. If I'm honest, I kind of felt like... because it was late and I'd been doing all the gigs that night and I didn't really want to go and play there at 5 o'clock in the morning. But now I look back and I'm thinking, you know, if without the Pleasure Rooms, I probably wouldn't have had as much, I'll say success, but success as I've had over the years, because it basically catapulted me into being like the benchmark for that bouncy house sound. I ended up being a resident at Wigan Pier, like you were for a while. I was doing all these Bounce Heaven gigs and like playing all, like from Land's End to John O'Groats. I was DJing every weekend up and down. It was all because... of the Pleasure Rooms, or what I played in the Pleasure Rooms.
Yeah.
I got Bounce 7 Best DJ of the Year Award 3 times because of that sound. Donk sound made me famous. So I've got a lot to thank for it,
listen,
really.
Listen, Rob, let's be honest about it. It's still a big scene.
It is.
Look at the Clubland Arena at Reminisce.
It's shocker.
Right,
An hour after opening.
This is the third year in Reminisce we've had to make that Clubland Arena bigger again.
Every year.
Bigger again. And like,
it's ridiculous.
People love it, but people are in denial.
They are. People don't want to admit they love it. The people who say they hate that shit are the ones at the front of that fucking, at the front of that stage at
people
10
turn
past
the nose
12
up at this,
every
this,
year.
Whatever this Scouse House brand is of music, whether you class it as that big, horrible donk that people talk about, or whether you class it as something like Lock and Low, blow your mind. But the fact of the matter is, there's some that don't think it's cool to like it,
but they know
every word to fucking You're Shining.
Yeah, of course they do, yeah, of course.
Do you know, like, so, we're not having music snobs on here, mate, we're just not, it's not allowed.
Okay.
It's cool to like whatever you
put
fucking want.
Put them into Room 101,
if you want to go in that Clubland Arena in denial, mate, with a fucking balaclava on so no one sees you, and bounce.
You still have that balaclava off after 10 minutes, mate, swinging it around your head with your T-shirt.
Yeah, with your jaw.
Like a Wigan Pier.
Swinging it around with your jaw. So, I'm going to give you now... track number 5 of the Rob Kane podcast. This is a tough question. Now, when I ask these, I often ask myself the same question. I know what my answer would be to this.
Yeah.
I know what my answer would be to this. I'd go for Breeze and Stiles, You're Shining.
So this is your favourite ever Scouse album?
I love that song.
Okay.
I still love that song. I still play that song. I did the Tunnels last Saturday. And as well as I went from the Tunnels, I went from Alison Limerick, the Reese Project's version of Alison Limerick, which is a big gospel version of Where Love Lives, to playing You're Shining towards the end.
Yeah.
Like, that's what's great about having an open mind for music, is like,
your boundaries,
why shouldn't you be able to manipulate your set?
Yeah.
So in the end, it ends up really fucking tough and bouncy.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah.
Like, Breeze and Stars, You're Shining, I just love the vocal. I love Mike's mix of it with that big, big, whatever that sound is, he runs along with the melody, follows the melody in it, and I just love it. But there's loads.
See, I'm on a different page to you, I think, here. See, for me, my favourite Scouse House anthem probably wouldn't be something that was around that Scouse House, like BCD type era. I was always really influenced by the Dutch house sounds.
Yeah, I know you were, yeah.
So stuff that, for me, like when the stuff that John Cotton was bringing back from Holland,
yeah,
that you were playing in the 05-1, that's what I was at.
So now,
club heads and stuff like that.
You've made a good point there, though. Like, if some people, you said to someone, oh, John Cotton, yeah, he plays Scouse House.
They'd tell you that was a knobhead, yeah.
Yeah, but how dare you say that about John? But the fact of the matter is, some of the stuff John played, Invisible Man, for example, is that what you're going to play?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, there's an example. Big, massive John Cotton tune. It is. Massive Dave Graham tune.
I remember hearing you played in the
05-1. Massive tune in the 05-1. So is that Scouse House? Because if it is...
Yeah, I think it is.
What a fucking amazingly credible song.
It is, it is.
And I would, if that is Scouse House, then you're opening Scouse House up to a bracket of DJs right across the world.
Of course, yeah.
From Tall Paul to John Cotton to Judge Jules.
I think everything sits under subgenres anyway, doesn't it? So something that you might think is, for instance, you might think it's hard house, might actually be hard style, or it might be hardcore or whatever. So it doesn't, you know, I don't think any one particular track can be pigeonholed to one particular genre. Besides, what are genres anyway?
Mate, it's too many genres,
isn't it?
Yeah, it's all house music.
Yeah, exactly. Either fast or it's slow.
Or
it's either energetic or it's not.
It's not, or it's soulful, or it's, you know, but you're right, there's too many little fucking genres and brackets. But here it is, you introduce it, this is a tune.
This is the DJ Rene and Groove power mix of Invisible Man. Give a little love.
Tune. What the Butler Saw, episode 3, myself and Rob Kane in the place. And of course, you can get this on my website, leebutler.co.uk, loads on there as well. And the other podcasts are there for you to listen to. So, we've just heard Rob Kane's favourite Scouse House tune. And what a tune that was. Reminds me of loads of people and loads of different DJs, as we just mentioned.
Yeah,
definitely
loads.
John Cotton.
John
definitely
Cotton himself.
Graham. Yeah.
Jed Clark used to play at the Sunrise as well.
Big Sunrise tune.
It is.
Big Sunrise tune.
Yeah.
So, and we'll have a little chat about drugs.
Okay.
Now, as you know, my story's quite public now about my recovery and where I ended up due to taking drugs. But what I won't do is shy away from the part I played in Liverpool's Clubland. It's pointless me being passionate about my recovery and helping other people, but not being open and honest about drugs and what part they played in it. People often ask me, do you regret taking drugs in 1989 and 1990 and 1991 when I first started taking ecstasy? And it's a hard question for me now because I do so much about recovery and so much interaction on my pages about helping people, and obviously lots of people email me and I stay in touch with loads of people and there's lots of people that I'm helping, but I'd be a liar if I said I didn't enjoy it.
Yeah.
At the start.
Yeah.
Of course I did. Because if I didn't...
Why would you do it?
I wouldn't have kept doing it. Exactly. And it wouldn't have led me from use to abuse to addiction, which it did with me. And my story's sort of quite complex in a sense that it started out in 89, 1991, where we were taking ecstasy.
Yeah.
And all this new house music and American house music and acid house music had come in, and all these amazing legal raves and all these lasers and lights and... They both went together.
Yeah.
And lots of that atmosphere you see generated from, like, they called it the Summer of Love in, like, 1991 was generated through ecstasy.
Yeah, of course.
And I'd be lying if I said it wasn't.
It was pivotal in the growth of dance music.
Of course
in the UK.
Of course it was. Now, I'm not saying you had to take ecstasy to have been part of that.
But we all did.
A part of that. No, but not everyone did.
Pretty much. I remember when I was going to the George on a Thursday night back in the 90s, and everyone was taking ecstasy. Everyone. Even the people who weren't drinking were still having a tablet.
It was a huge part of that rave revolution. It was a massive...
That was a Thursday in a pub. Thursday night
it was a massive
pub.
Part of it. And so it's... I feel like I need to be careful, but I don't want to be careful about it because I don't want people to go, well, he's advocating taking drugs when he was there. But I'm not. I'm just, what I can't do is lie about it. All my posts I do about recovery are all fucking dead honest.
I'll talk about the pain
it brought me and like how it affected my life and my marriage and my work and my health and everything else and my mental state. But that was because my ecstasy use in them early years, 89, 90, 91, 92, 93, 94, 95, 96, was predominantly still ecstasy, led me to cocaine.
Yeah.
And cocaine's a totally different drug
than ecstasy.
But, you know, I have people on the podcast and John Cotton touched on it, on drugs and stuff like that, and what a big part it was. And was it a big part for you?
Yeah, because I enjoyed it. And I think it went so hand in hand, both drugs and dance music, that it was impossible to shy away from, especially in the 90s. Everyone was at it. As I said, everyone was at it that I knew. And most people are still at it now. It's hard to get away from, isn't it, really?
It is, yeah.
I'm quite lucky in the respect that I've got a great home network at home.
Yeah.
My wife is really supportive. I've got two great kids. I mean, I don't need to go out every weekend and get absolutely off my barnet anymore. It's just not... I'm more about, you know, music and entertaining and... That's what I'm
and family, yeah, and your future.
And family and friends and making music and spending time in your studio and just doing things that make me happy.
Yeah.
I don't feel the need to get absolutely blitzed 4 or 5 times a week anymore.
I mean, I know from having gone public about my recovery and my addiction, that I know now. I knew anyway, because I sat in recovery groups for fucking 8 years trying to get clean. And I tried AA, I tried Addaction. So I've sat there in groups of 20 people with old stories and different nightmare stories and women who'd lost their kids because of their use and horrible, horrible fellas, solicitors, joiners, housewives, every fucking walk of life.
Yeah.
Walk of life can have an addiction.
Yeah, of course.
So I know where it leads and where it led me, but we can't get away from the fact that in them early years,
I think it's still pivotal now.
But that's where I was going with it. There's lots of people who reach out for me for some advice or a little bit of support or to point them in the right direction or just a bit of inspiration to make the change is people who were at it then, like I was,
yeah,
who haven't been able to stop, like I couldn't. You know, it's 3 years for me now, and I know I'll never go back, but it took me a long time to get to this point.
I think some people are different, aren't they? For me,
I do get it from mums who contact me about their young kids who are 20, who are taking snorting cocaine, and it's wrecking their lives. Yeah. They've lost the relationship, they can't see the kid anymore. But then I get it from people who are 45, 50, around my age, who came through that scene and are still doing it, and they want to stop.
I've always been able to switch off. This is where I'm lucky, you see, because a lot of people, like yourself included, would just get on it and go for it until you either ran out of money or you were getting bin bagged by your beards.
That didn't stop me either.
I'd come home, and if I'd had a good night, I'd get into bed and I'd go to sleep. I'd wake up and I'd have my breakfast.
The thing is, which I eventually learned, was if I start, I can't stop. And I'm talking like I will continually drink and use drugs until, if I get kicked out, I'll then go somewhere else and carry on.
Yeah.
And I'll do it anyway. I would have drunk until I can't breathe. Yeah. I've snorted cocaine till I've got palpitations and I think I'm going to have to take myself to the hospital on day 4. And then once my heart calms down...
You need to donate your body to medical science, mate.
I know. I was that bad that once... I'd be having these palpitations and I couldn't breathe in the house.
He'd have another line.
Right, and once it stopped, I'd go, I'm all right now, and I'd carry on. It was like addiction when it gets you to that point of surrender. So when people ask me, do you regret it? I regret where it took me.
Yeah.
I regret where it took me, and I wish that I would never gone to that place. But I can't say I didn't enjoy it at the start. Of course I did. They had some of the best nights in my life. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
The,
so
the people you met, the music you listen to, it all becomes like a big drug hazed blur, doesn't it, sometimes?
Yeah, I speak to lots of people who were part of that ecstasy revolution in from 90 to maybe 96, 97, who were now grown up and got kids and they would never dream of doing it again. But they look back and they loved it.
Yeah,
so we can't always look back and go, oh no, I wish that I'd never done that, because we think we're saying something bad. I'm just being fucking honest.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And like, you know, for you, probably when you were going 18, 19, I take it you were part of that.
Yeah, of course I was, yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah, I was heavy into, initially I was into like LSD and mushrooms.
Well,
I did.
So I was taking trips in like 1990, MBS and Conan the Barbarians.
When I was in school, Mick Jaggers and Microdots.
Microdots.
I was heavy into that, but they used to freak me out a little bit.
So Conan the Barbarians we used to have as well.
Conan the Barbarians. When she kind of hit me, I was like, well, yeah, this is probably for me, this. And we were in clubs like every weekend.
Is there no party to regret any of your drug use? It didn't lead you to a bad enough place.
No, not really. No, I've never been to the bottom of the barrel. Really, I've always been quite grounded. I've had reasons.
Yeah, she's
been through me through thick and thin, and I've never had any really.
Listen,
bad
so's mine. How my wife has stuck with me after the way I was and the way I went missing due to drugs and drink, and the strain it put on our relationship and the kids.
But it can do,
and everything else. I wouldn't have put up with it off air.
Yeah.
I doubt it. If I was going out of a Saturday night, Rob, I'm coming home on a Tuesday morning regularly. Right?
It depends what a job is, doesn't it, really? Like, do you think? If she was DJing and doing all that shit, do you think you'd be a little bit more lenient?
Do you like, well, let's put the shoe on the other foot. Cool. Your wife's a DJ.
Yeah.
She goes to work on a Saturday night. Right. And she comes home on Tuesday morning. I'll be
fuming, mate. Yeah, you can't. That's why your wife was fuming, isn't it?
And you're doing that regularly.
Yeah, but that's why she was fuming, though, isn't it?
Listen, that's what I'm saying to you. I don't think I could have pulled up with that,
but
like she did.
Knowing what you know,
I know I was. I know I was only
getting off your.
I was off my cake somewhere.
Yeah, that's it.
What makes me laugh is the ability to do any fucking shagger, mate, when you're fucking coked up is non-existent.
Yeah, of course.
There was nothing like that going on. It was me and me drugs and me drink and me ego.
Yeah.
Acting like a fucking hero.
Yeah.
Not realising the important things that I had, which I now do realise, which is why I now have changed. But I learned that there's no middle ground with me. I can't pick a drink up because if I drink, it will lead me back to drugs. Absolutely. Like, it doesn't mean I couldn't go for a meal with my wife and have a glass of wine and I'm going to phone up for fucking three bags of fucking Charlie. Of course it doesn't mean that. But I learned in my recovery, and I went in times in the past when I've been a good length of time clean and sober and I've ended up lapsing and started taking drugs again. It's always been through me starting to drink. So, last time I lapsed years ago, I got blagged that I'd be all right to drink. I was going.
It's a catalyst, isn't it?
I reckon I'd be all right to have a drink now.
Yeah.
My addiction was saying to me, I reckon you could have a drink now. It's a couple of years since you've done anything like that. You've learned, you'd never go back. Have a glass of wine with your wife, you're going on holiday. So I did. And that glass of wine with me missus led me to a glass of beer with the lads, which led me to a drink while I was in work, which within 3 weeks led me to, do you want one of these, Lee? A line. And then within a month, I was using again. And then I couldn't stop again for 12 months.
Yeah.
I was just like, as soon as I put my foot in the water, wallop.
You're all or nothing.
I can't stop.
Yeah.
So eventually I learned that it's all or nothing for me. And I'd never go back. If someone said to me now, I've got a magic potion, you can take a spoonful of this. And once you've took it, you'll be able to have a drink, Lee, and you'll never think about drugs again.
Yeah.
I can guarantee you can drink and you won't have any drugs. I still wouldn't have it.
Yeah.
I don't want to drink. It's gone. I see my bed and the hangovers that my missus has, and I see my daughter's 22 and she goes out.
Yeah.
And I see them absolutely dying in bed for days, and I'm like, oh, fucking don't miss that. Yeah. So I've just changed. It's a way of life for me now.
Yeah.
And I've filled it with all them things you spoke about, family, music, health, the gym, my businesses, Raven Fit.
Yeah.
I would never have been able to do any of them the way I was because I wasn't fit and healthy enough. I was just using for 4 days, crying for 2 days, doing it again in that vicious cycle. So luckily you haven't got, you're the type of person that can go,
I'm going to bed.
Get to fucking bed.
Yeah, that's it. I'm first asleep, mate.
Yeah.
I back to order the parties and everything, mate.
Yeah. You're that bastard that used to look at and go, how does he do that? How does he get asleep?
Well, he's ordering more. See ya, bye.
So look, we're near the end of this, mate. I'm thrilled to bits you've come in because I know, I get the honesty out of you. I know your passion for your music, which is what I love here. Advice, we've touched on this earlier on. And you probably get this as well as I do, well, DJs, young DJs that love the tunes and they've got themselves a set of decks or they've got themselves a controller and whatever they want to mix on.
Yeah.
Great. And the mums maybe will message it, or they will drop
me
a message
and
say, I've just started mixing. Can you give me any advice on what to do to become a DJ? It's fucking hard, isn't it, Rob?
It's hard to give them
that honest advice because there you've got a young lad or girl that is passionate about becoming a DJ And there's not great money in, is there, Rob?
No. There isn't.
Not enough to...
No, there isn't. Otherwise, you wouldn't be doing so much stuff, would you, Lee?
That's no, what I'm saying... I'm lucky, Rob. I'm lucky. I've got great history in Liverpool. I've been part of some of the most amazing nightclubs and had a big part in putting them on. I've built my Reminisce Festival up. I've been on radio for, like, 15 years.
Yeah.
So I'm lucky that I've gathered a huge following of people.
Yeah, of course,
like, they feel like they've grew up with me. And I'm lucky enough to be...
really hard to get, Lee. And it's almost impossible nowadays.
Absolutely,
in the city,
but I'm very
that.
Lucky and blessed, and I'm so grateful that I've got the younger generation that sisters and brothers and mums grew up with, that come and see me as well. So I'm very lucky in that sense to have that. But young DJs now, they couldn't support a wife and family.
No.
By being a DJ. And well, that's the truth.
I actually teach DJing at Mode Training every
Wednesday.
It's
a brilliant place.
If you think about on the roster as well, with all the DJs, we've got Les Calvert, who does Mondays, then you've got Mark Armstrong, who does Tuesdays, me on a Wednesday, and I believe that Kaidus, you know, John Tomo, is going to be doing production there as well. So it's, you know, it's a perfect way to learn how to...
So if anyone's listening to this podcast, Mode
Training, if you look them up on Instagram.
Music production and DJing. Music,
yeah, but you can also do hairdressing there if you want, Lee.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's music production and DJing, all comes with the one qualification. I think you can get on the course for free now if you're aged over 19 and you're earning less than 17.5 grand a year. So, you know, the opportunity's there to come and
it's a brilliant
better
place.
Yourself.
I've been
it's amazing.
There.
I know you have. I've seen you there.
It's a brilliant place.
Yeah.
So, what advice would you give to a DJ?
I would say, first and foremost, get yourself a day job. You need money. You can't survive on a dream.
Do it as a passion.
You've got it. Yeah, for to start off.
Which we all did, Rob.
We all had jobs. I was lucky enough. I worked in record shops.
No, but we all initially
years,
did it for the passion of the music, didn't we?
That's it. It wasn't. It was never a status thing when we.
No,
wanted
I never
to DJ.
Wanted. I never
I
even
to be famous.
I never even thought about it being
I
a job.
I just wanted to make people dance and entertain them.
I was just doing it. I was doing like the Phoenix and Canny Farm, Eton Labour Clubs, Dovey Labour. Because I enjoy playing music to people. And even then I was playing like Motown and like Third Finger Left Hand.
Yeah.
I was playing fucking Come On Eileen. But I didn't care.
Yeah.
Because it got me my money to go and buy me house music.
Exactly, that's it.
And then that, luckily for me, led on to the state.
I was a kitchen porter. I was emptying bins.
I think the main gist for these young DJs now is start making music.
Yeah.
Make your own music.
So that would be your next step, yeah. Get yourself a computer and start making tunes.
The opportunity for people now, if they have one big hit. Look at Avicii, for example, the late, the great. Well, look at Martin Garrix with Animals.
Even more current and local is Sosa. You've heard of Sosa?
Yeah.
I mean, he's been around about
18 months,
and now he's smashing it.
It's slightly different with Camel Fat because they did a lot before.
Oh, yeah, but Rob,
that one song changed it for them.
Yeah.
And it's doable. As a young producer, you can. It's tough. But if you're producing music, other DJs are playing music of yours in their sets and they're coming to you, any more new music, you are more likely to start getting better gigs. You're more likely to have a chance of breaking a big song and breaking into that sort of better paid bracket.
Yeah.
So there's your advice and mine.
Yeah, make music.
Start getting to work
bloody hard as well. Try and be a bit individual as well if you can. If you can try and think outside the box and not be too obvious all the time. Just make yourself stand out a bit different.
Don't be scared to do something different.
Yeah.
Be creative. If it doesn't work, it doesn't matter.
Yeah. If your niche is going to be making remixes of, I don't know, Simon and Carl Garfunkel, then go for it. If that's what you're into, just do your thing.
Yeah. Good advice. So we've got to the end of the podcast, right? And we think of this podcast as a DJ set.
Yeah.
Right, so we've been talking about music.
Yeah.
You've got 2,000 people in front of you there, Rob. You've got your best cap on. You've just come back off your holiday.
You've had a shave.
Right, you've just come back off a week away on holiday. Your suntan is absolutely on fire. You've got a white top on, which is showcasing your tan. And people in the crowd have actually said, fucking Rob looks fit tonight. So you've got to finish off with one of the biggest tunes, an end of the night anthem.
Okay.
What is your choice?
My end of the night anthem stems from back when I was resident at Barrett. Okay. And this was a track at the time by a remix by a guy that no one had heard of at the time. And his name was Steve Angelo. And he went on to be part of Swedish House Mafia.
Yep.
The biggest acts in the world ever, dance music. And it's a remix of Moby. And it's Raining Again. And this is the Steve Angelo remix of
what
Moby.
What an absolute tune this is. This is Rob Kane's end of the night anthem.
Strings.
Moby, Raymond again, and thank you, Rob, for joining us today.
Thanks, Lee.
You're a super cool dude, mate, and I've loved having you on.
Thank you. Love being here.
Oh, and it's raining again. Loud on your car like bullets on tin. Oh, and it's raining again.
open the door and pulling me in. Sadness like water raining down, raining down,
raining down. Oh yeah.
Sadness like water raining down, raining down.
What the Butler Saw with Lee Butler. The podcast. Subscribe now. Visit leebutler.co.uk.